This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents The Stephen King Companion, Four Decades of Fear from the Master of Horror. Written by George Beam, performed by Fleet Cooper and Claire Christie.
Foreword. The Learned Astronomer. Stephen Spignesi. This introduction is dedicated to the memory of Rocky Wood. In order for the light to shine so brightly, the darkness must be present. Francis Bacon. It was the possibility of darkness that made the day seem so bright. Stephen King. Wolves of the Kala. Is writing nature or nurture? Is the ability to write brilliantly inherent? Is it in the genes? Or is it just a craft that one gets better at with hard work? Lately, whenever I speak about Stephen King in different venues, I read aloud a brief excerpt from the writings of Joe Hill, Stephen King's eldest son. I then ask the audience if they believe that Stephen King wrote what they just heard. The majority of times they say yes. King himself was once asked what would happen to his unfinished works if he unexpectedly, you know, took a ride on a pale horse. His response was revealing and boiled down to, Joe could finish them. Is it a coincidence that the writers Stephen King and Tabitha King gave birth to a son who ended up being a writer and, more important, a writer whose work reads like that of his father's? I don't think so. And let us not overlook the fact that their other children are also writers. Owen is a novelist. Naomi writes essays and sermons. I teach composition at the university level, and I ceaselessly emphasize to my students that writing is, indeed, a craft that can be learned. We wouldn't attempt to wire a house without learning the skills of an electrician. Language skills and rules, syntax and diction guidelines, and, of course, a voluminous vocabulary need to be learned and fully absorbed before we can use these tools effectively. This is sadly proved by reading the writings of people who may have a terrific imagination, but who never troubled to acquire the fundamentals of grammar and writing. As Irving Berlin said, talent is only a starting point. And King himself weighs in on this in Danse Macabre. Talent is a dreadfully cheap commodity, cheaper than table salt. What separates the talented individual from the successful one is a lot of hard work. That said, I also tell my students that no teacher can teach imagination. Creativity cannot be learned from a book, but, and this is key, if you have it, it can be cultivated. In Breaking Bad, Gail Bedecker, probably without intent, made this exact point when he recited the Walt Whitman poem, When I Heard the Learned Astronomer, to Walter White. When I heard the learned astronomer, when the proofs, the figures, were ranged in columns before me, when I was shown the charts and the diagrams to add, divide, and measure them, when I, sitting, heard the astronomer, where he lectured with much applause in the lecture room, how soon, unaccountable, I became tired and sick, till rising and gliding out, I wandered off by myself in the mystical, moist night air, and from time to time looked up in perfect silence at the stars. Knowledge of the empirical world is one thing. An understanding of the human heart is quite another. The creative among us can see beyond the proofs, the charts, and diagrams. Some can see truth, and then they can create. And that brings me to Stephen King. Aside from his prolificness, his output amazes and makes most writers' eyes turn green, his ability to take the classic and time-worn writer's cliché, what if, and create compelling characters and narratives is oftentimes a beautiful and wondrous melding of inspiration and creativity, as well as an obvious master's-level proficiency of the English language. The first Stephen King book I ever read was The Shining. I finished it and then rhetorically asked myself, Did I really just read what might be one of the all-time greatest American novels? Written while the author was still in his mid to late 20s? Who the hell is Stephen King? And yes, I can be prolix when I'm talking to myself rhetorically, truth be told. After The Shining, I went back and read Carrie and Salem's Lot. And in 1981, I read Danse Macabre, in which King talks about the three levels of fear, terror, horror, gross out. As you can tell, I was hooked. And I have continued to be hooked going on 40 years now. A UK review of Revival nailed the King appeal. Despite the fact that he could comfortably rest on his laurels as the world's most successful writer of horror fiction, Stephen King continues to demonstrate that his compulsion to entertain remains firmly in place, a fact for which his legion of admirers is extremely grateful. Once more, King is not content simply to repeat himself, and he still possesses the ability to conjure up utterly original scenarios dedicated to his primary purpose, chilling the blood of the reader. Chilled blood? Where do I sign up? We should have jackets made. The three elements of fear are deep in King's wheelhouse. One of the most terrifying scenes King ever wrote was the Lincoln Tunnel scene in The Stand. Just describing it can bring chills. The Lincoln Tunnel is filled with cars containing the corpses of the victims of Captain Trips. Larry Underwood enters this blackest-pitch realm of the dead and suddenly hears a car door open. Oh, yes. And can there be a more horrifying scene than little Gage Creed getting pureed by a tractor trailer after wandering into the middle of the road in Pet Cemetery? Oh, no. And when we talk gross out, there are a couple that make the grade, so to speak. The cockroach scene in They're Creeping Up on You from Creepshow, and the suicide by garbage disposal scene in Firestarter. The axe-slash-blowtorch scene in Misery is a seriously close runner-up. Oh, gag. This profound ability to frighten is why King has long worn, sometimes uneasily, the mantle of Master of the Macabre, King of Horror, or America's Boogeyman. But the truth is that King is much more than just a horror writer. In an October 2013 article in The New Yorker titled, What Stephen King Isn't, Joshua Rothman lays out the truth we serious fans and constant readers, including George Beam, the author of this tome, have known for decades. What Stephen King isn't is just a horror writer. My good friend George Beam and I have now come full circle. I was working on my Complete Stephen King Encyclopedia in the mid-80s when George was writing the first Stephen King Companion, and they came out around the same time. George is now doing the third edition of his seminal book, and I am working on a huge Stephen King book I'm not ready to announce, but which I am almost certain will be my last book about Stephen King. This new one will be at least a couple of years or more in the making. And no, it's not an update of my Complete Stephen King Encyclopedia. George and I were pioneers. We both recognized very early on that Stephen King was a writer for the ages, and that he was, as the New Yorker seemed to discover 25 years later, more than just a horror writer. I recently spoke about Stephen King at the university where I teach, and there was a very big turnout. The university librarian, in her thank you note to me, commented on the many hands that went up for the Q&A session at the end of my talk. There were people of all ages at the talk, but most were students, 18 to 21 years of age, and they were the ones asking the questions. Here's a funny incident. A young man asked me, "Where does Stephen King get his ideas?" To which I replied, "Congratulations. You win the prize for asking the question King gets and hates the most." We all laughed, but it's true. So I said that King, when asked the question, often replies, "Utica." But then I explained seriously that King is a master at the writer's classic what-if question. And then I said, for example, What if Annie Wilkes from Misery suddenly burst through that library door swinging an axe? King is able to take that what-if scenario and run with it. And more than a few heads turned to look uneasily at the library door. That was when I knew I had achieved my mission. I think an important point to keep in mind is that George and I, as well as all our colleagues who write books about Stephen King and his work, are writing because King's constant readers want to know more. This is not up for debate. They want insights, explications, details, discussions, and other info they don't possess about King, his writings, and now the other published writers in his family. They want expert opinion on the film adaptations. They want conversations and debates. They want to stay in the Stephen King universe just a little bit longer. Books like The Stephen King Companion and other King-focused volumes remind me somewhat of the special features on DVDs for TV shows and movies. We watch an episode, or 10, and when we're done, we want to know more. We want to experience more. This is why the behind-the-scenes features and making-of features on DVDs are incredibly popular. Frankly, there are not many popular writers whose work warrants this kind of attention, whose audience wants more. If there were, there would be companion books, encyclopedias, lost works books, quiz books, and all other manner of tomes about these writers. For the most part, people read a novel, and then they either put it on the shelf, give it away, or donate it. People rarely do this with Stephen King books. In fact, with King, it's the exact opposite. If you ask a room full of King fans, how many of you have more than one copy of many of your King books? A multitude of hands would go up. This is amazing, and mostly unique to King. Will King's work survive? It's a fair question. And the answer is, the best of it, most certainly. Will readers still be reading King 50 years from now? Again, certainly. Books like The Stand, It, Misery, The Shining, Salem's Lot, Revival, and many others do not simply go away. They become part of the culture of new generations. Just like the Beatles. I have 18-year-old students who are Beatles authorities. And how do these young people get exposed to King and the Fab Four? Their parents. Many college-age students today grew up in homes with Stephen King books and Beatles CDs. And thus the word is spread to younger generations, and the torch is passed. A book like the one you're holding contributes to spreading the word that Stephen King rocks, as did the Beatles, and as did Walt Whitman. The road goes ever on. Introduction. The Golden Years. George Beam. I'm closing in on 62. I might have 10 productive years left, 20 if I'm lucky and don't get hit by any more minivans. Stephen King, from his column, The Pop of King, Entertainment Weekly, July 24th, 2009. Time on my side. Although King planned to take a break in 2014, he changed his mind and hit the road to promote Revival in November. At an age when most people are retired and enjoying their golden years, King is still hammering down the highway, pedal flat down to the metal. In recent years, he's settled in on publishing 2 books annually. King will turn 68 on September 21st, 2015. He shows no signs of slowing down, much less retiring, which is good news for his millions of fans, whose worst nightmare is that in his golden years he's going to put down the pen or turn off the computer and tend to his garden as did Sherlock Holmes. King's 40-year-long writing career, encompassing poetry, screenplays, nonfiction, short fiction, and book-length fiction, staggers the imagination. From his body of work, bibliographies and concordances of his oeuvre have been compiled, as have critical studies of his fiction and nonfiction, and even entire books on single aspects of his output. Though his life had nearly been cut short by a reckless driver who hit him with a minivan, King miraculously survived, endured a painful recovery, and slowly picked up where he left off. As King realized, nothing can protect you from the randomness of the universe. In his case, a fool behind a wheel who drove on the shoulder of the road where King had gone for an afternoon walk. King's near-death experience shook him up. As King vividly recounted in his most personal and poignant essay in On Writing, he came close to crossing over. "I don't want to die. I love my wife, my kids, my afternoon walks by the lake. I also love to write. I have a book on writing that's sitting back home on my desk, half finished. I don't want to die, and as I lie in the helicopter looking out at the bright blue summer sky, I realize that I am actually lying in death's doorway. Someone is going to pull me one way or the other pretty soon. It's mostly out of my hands." King fortuitously survived, but his sobering experience understandably affected him deeply, and in his subsequent fiction, he increasingly ponders the greatest mystery of all. What lies beyond this world? What happens when you shuck your mortal coil and cross over? We cannot know for certain, but what we do know, and what we plan our lives around, is the undeniable fact that time is an irreplaceable resource. We only have a finite amount of it. As Gandalf reminded Frodo in The Fellowship of the Ring, all we have to decide is what to do with the time that is given us. King, by choice and inclination, has spent his lifetime writing. It is his way of passing his time productively, of keeping his imagination active, of making sense of the universe in an attempt to understand it. Writing also provided a one-way ticket out of the misery he suffered in the wake of the accident. In pain and on painkillers, King wrote his way out of his bleak situation. In On Writing, he concluded, "Writing isn't about making money, getting famous, getting dates, getting laid, or making friends. In the end, it's about enriching the lives of those who will read your work, and enriching your own life as well. It's about getting up, getting well, and getting over. Getting happy, okay? Okay." Let us hope that King's optimistic appraisal of his remaining years of productivity is realized. And let us realize, too, that there will come a point when, by choice or circumstance, he will put down his pen and write the end to his stellar writing career and know that he gave it his all. He writes like a man possessed because he wants as many stories as possible to take flight and soar out of his imagination, because he wants to create. Also, isn't it high time that we dispense with the hoary stereotype that he is just a horror writer? For various reasons, including his self-deprecating comments about being the literary equivalent of a Big Mac and fries, King's been tarred as a genre writer who writes only about spooks and monsters and things that go bump in the night. Make no mistake, he does write about monsters, but more often, especially these days, the monsters walk among us unnoticed. To paraphrase Walt Kelly's Pogo, we have met the monsters, and they are us. Read A Good Marriage in Full Dark, No Stars, and you'll see what I mean. King will never shed, as he put it, his reputation as America's best-loved boogeyman, but we know better. The man who wrote The Body, Rita Hayworth and Shawshank Redemption, The Reach, and The Man in the Black Suit is no mere genre writer, and it's a disservice to him to even think so, despite the assertions of the literati who consider him little more than a best-selling outsider in the world of fiction. The Outsider and Others. When Stephen King and his best friend, Chris Chesley, went to the Ritz Theater in Lewiston for Saturday matinees, in interviews, King explains that he carried his birth certificate to prove that he shouldn't be charged an adult fare, because he was adult size. He stood 6'2". Today he stands 6'3". Stephen was ungainly, according to his brother, Dave, who told Spignesi in an interview for the Complete Stephen King Encyclopedia that Stevie was husky and he wasn't too well coordinated. He looked like Vern in the film Stand By Me. Abandoned by his father and physically distanced from his peers because of his height and lack of coordination, it was his passion for writing that proved to be his ticket to gaining social acceptance, especially when he lampooned authority figures in a parody of the high school newspaper. Hilarity ensued among his admiring classmates when he self-published The Village Vomit. But his fledgling career as a satirist came to an abrupt halt. He earned a trip to the principal's office because his newspaper took personal digs at teachers and staffers. The Village Vomit earned King a 3-day suspension. Moreover, his teachers were not amused, least of all the draconian Miss Maggot Margitan, who, as King wrote in On Writing, commanded both respect and fear. She obviously didn't share Steve King's adolescent sense of humor. She was the one who had pressed for his suspension. She followed up with a veto when King was nominated for entry into the National Honor Society. She never forgot the sting of his juvenile jabs, and it came back to haunt him. King quickly learned that making fun of people at their expense would kick him in the ass. The next time he published his perceptions about high school, it would be Carrie, a novel about high school hell that drew on his position as an outsider. King saw high school as socially stratified, a caste system with reigning prom queens, cheerleaders, and jocks on top as part of the in crowd, and everyone else far below, including Steve King, as part of the out crowd. In the professional world of fiction writing, King was also an outsider. Perceived as a horror writer early on, he got no respect. Fuming, King, as a sign of protest, spent $12,000 to buy tables at a National Book Awards ceremony. He invited his friend John Grisham and others to make their presence known. If he couldn't get in through the front door, he was storming the gates from the back. He seemed to be saying, "We're here, we're writing, and you can't ignore us, because we aren't going away." Years later, when King received the National Book Award for Distinguished Contributions to American Letters, some of the literati howled in protest. Writing about people whom we'd recognize, our family, our friends, our neighbors, who get caught up in extraordinary situations, Stephen King's body of work reflects our times to such an extent and in such vivid and memorable prose that in the future, historians will look to him to show what it was like to live in the 20th and early 21st centuries. As King explained to the Paris Review, "If you go back over the books from Carrie on up, what you see is an observation of ordinary middle-class American life as it's lived at the time that particular book was written. He has captured American middle-class hopes and fears, brand names and subtle nuances with remarkable fidelity. He is, simply, America's storyteller, though he's most often perceived and categorized as a horror writer." In the beginning was the Word. Although the book industry is going through a sea change, with the growing popularity of e-books and multiple devices, what hasn't changed is, as King puts it, the primacy of the written word. As he explained in a Facebook posting, "Official Stephen King, September 28, 2014. Books have been around for 3-4 centuries. There's a deeply implanted desire and understanding and wanting of a book that isn't there with music. It's a deeper well of human experience." King, in drawing from that well, has drawn unique and memorable portraits of people whom we remember, some drawn with fondness, some with love, and others with well-earned revulsion. From the put-upon, victimized Carrie White, Carrie, 1974, to a fallen-away minister named Charles Jacobs, Revival, 2014, we see an endless parade of the good and the bad reflected in the mirror King holds up to the world. And in the end, we see, with startling clarity, ourselves. Part 1. Main Roots. Durham at that time was a different place than it is now. The old small farm ethic, which had been the rule for many generations past, was just on its way out, and what we had was a community where people got up in the morning and went to work in the factories in the surrounding towns. It was a working-class rural town. Chris Chesley, interviewed in The Complete Stephen King Encyclopedia. 1. Family Roots. Donald Edwin Pollock. At his winter home in Florida, Stephen King sat down with Dr. Henry Louis Gates Jr. for an appearance on the PBS television show Finding Your Roots. Combing genealogical and military records, Gates' research team turned up a wealth of information about King's father, Donald. The compiled information, assembled scrapbook style for King's perusal, was an eye-opener for King, who understandably wanted to know more about the father who abandoned his family in 1949, when Stephen was 2 years old. According to what he remembers, his mom said, his dad went out for a pack of cigarettes and never returned. Leafing through the leather-bound scrapbook, Stephen King turned the page and saw a black-and-white photograph of a 6-foot-tall man with glasses. Gates asks, "Now, you know who that is?" Stephen King replies, "Not right offhand." He pauses. "Is that my dad?" In a shock of late recognition, Stephen exclaims, "He looks like me. A little bit." He shakes his head and has a wistful expression on his face. "No kidding," said Gates. It was Stephen King's father. But his birth name isn't Donald Edwin King. As Gates pointed out, a record of birth and military records show that his name was Donald Edwin Pollock. 25 at the time of his marriage to Nellie Ruth Pillsbury, Donald listed his occupation as seaman in the Merchant Marine. On David King's birth record, his father's occupation is listed as Master Mariner. And on Stephen King's birth certificate, he's listed as Captain, Merchant Marine. From there, Gates takes Stephen King on a genealogical trip into the past, showing that his roots go all the way back to Ireland on his father's side. Despite the considerable passage of time, there are still unresolved issues and anger that fester in Stephen King, who is upset at the circumstances and consequences of his dad's unexplained departure. Stephen King told Gates, "I can remember as a kid thinking of myself, well, if I ever meet my dad, I'm going to sock him in the mouth for leaving my mother. And as I got older, I would think, well, I want to find out why he left and what he did, and then I'll sock him." King and Gates have a good laugh over that. But the question that's haunted Stephen King for all those years will forever remain unanswered. Who was Donald E. Pollock? Stephen King's father died at age 66 in Wind Gap, Pennsylvania, but as to which cemetery, I couldn't determine. The largest, though, is Fairview Cemetery, near a town called Bangor. As to his public records, they show that he remarried, and genealogical records online indicate 5 children by that marriage. As to what he left behind in the wreckage of his first marriage, what we do know is that Nellie Ruth Pillsbury King picked up the shattered pieces of her family's lives and heroically moved on. scrambling to make ends meet in her new and unexpected role as the family's breadwinner, survival became an extended family affair, with her four sisters helping out. David King recalls moving all over the map until they finally dropped anchor and settled in for the long haul in Durham. Aided financially by her siblings, Nellie Ruth was a single mother who not only raised two young boys, but also her aging parents in a small two-story house in Durham, Maine, that lacked a bathtub or shower. It'd be difficult enough to be a caregiver even with a spouse to share the burden, but to do it essentially alone was an act of quiet courage and iron resolve. She was not going to abandon her family as her husband did. A child's worst nightmare. The emotions of fear and horror are inextricable in King's fiction, and justifiably so. There was, as Chesley pointed out, no respite for Stephen King's powerful imagination, which conjured up awful possibilities. But the fear began early on in King's life when he was abandoned by his father. A small child's worst nightmare. Parents, after all, are supposed to be a bedrock, a solid platform on which children build their lives. But when one parent leaves for whatever reasons, children often blame themselves. Was it something I did? They endlessly torture themselves, asking a question that can't be answered. Why? Conjecture is no replacement for knowledge, and understandably, the fear of abandonment prefigures largely in King's early fiction. Carrietta White, Carrie, whose mother is a fundamentalist Christian, raising her alone. Danny Torrance, The Shining, whose dysfunctional father is slowly spiraling out of control. Charlene Charlie McGee, Firestarter, whose mother dies at the hands of the nefarious federal agents at The Shop, and others. The repercussions of parental abandonment reverberate in King's fiction, as they clearly do for Stephen King himself, who was never able to take out his long simmering anger on his dad and punch him out. He can only live with the knowledge that, as Dick Halloran tells Danny Torrance in the epilogue to The Shining, "The world's a hard place, Danny. It don't care. It don't have you and me, but it don't love us either. Terrible things happen in this world, and they're things no one can explain. But see that you get on. That's your job in this hard world, to keep your love alive and see that you get on, no matter what. Pull your act together and just go on." With his mother as his shining example, Stephen King went on to do just that. He went on. Flotsam and Jetsam. The expression around the King family was that Daddy done gone, and what he left behind, the physical artifacts from his past, had been boxed and stored at a relative's house down the street. Aunt Ethelyn and her husband, Orrin, kept the flotsam and jetsam of Donald King's life in their attic, where one day Stephen went to see what he could find, the only physical remains of what once was presumed to be a good marriage. In Spignesi's The Complete Stephen King Encyclopedia, David King was asked, "What do you remember about your father?" David King replied, "Nothing. I don't remember the man personally at all. I do remember that at one point, I guess when we got back to Durham, Maine, Stevie and I found a trunk up in Aunt Ethelyn's garage that contained a lot of books on seamanship and that sort of thing. And in fact, there was even one of his Merchant Marine uniforms in it. We also had several still pictures of him and one 16mm film that he had taken. One scene from that film that I can remember was of the ship he was on going through a storm. There were waves crashing over the bow and everything. And surprisingly, since this was the mid-1940s, there were also some shots on that reel in color. Footage of both Stevie and I as little kids running around." In Danse Macabre, Stephen King wrote that he found in their attic boxes of his father's past, now gathering dust and long abandoned, Merchant Marine manuals and scrapbooks of his travels worldwide, including an 8mm movie reel, Sans Sound, which he shared with David. They saw for the first time their father waving to them in absentia. From Danse Macabre. He raises his hand, smiles, unknowingly waves to sons who were then not even conceived. We rewound it, watched it, rewound it, watched it again, and again. Hi, Dad. Wonder where you are now. Their dad, as it turned out, left Maine permanently and headed to Pennsylvania, where he would settle down permanently. He would remarry and raise kids with his new wife. But the boys had no way of knowing that. All they knew was that their father had left. One thing Donald did leave behind, a blessing in disguise, was a box of cheap paperbacks, science fiction and horror, which Ruth said were his main interests, the kind of fiction he enjoyed reading. An aspiring writer, Donald King had tried his hand at writing fiction, even submitting items for publications, collecting a few rejection slips. In time, if Donald King had applied himself to the craft of writing fiction, he might have produced a saleable manuscript. But that never happened, possibly because, as Stephen in Danse Macabre recalls Ruth explaining, your father didn't have a great deal of stick-to-it in his nature. That afternoon in the dusty attic was a defining moment for a young Stephen King, who in Danse Macabre recalls what happened afterward. The compass needle swung emphatically towards some mental true north when he found a treasure trove of horror novels published by Avon. It was his first fictional encounter with the boogeyman of Providence, Rhode Island. A tall, saturnine-looking man named Howard Phillips Lovecraft, better known as H.P. Lovecraft. A Lovecraft collection was, recalled King, the pick of the litter. Lovecraft, courtesy of my father, opened the way for me, as he had done for others before me. Robert Bloch, Clark Ashton Smith, Frank Belknap Long, Fritz Lieber, and Ray Bradbury among them. Had Stephen King not found the box of horror books, would he have eventually turned to horror fiction? Or would he have turned in another direction? Perhaps the books he'd eventually pen under the Richard Bachman pen name. It's a moot point because King found himself comfortably at home with the horror writers, the fantasists, the dark dreamers. Stephen, as a fledgling writer, would ironically follow in his father's footsteps. But where his father ultimately failed, Stephen would eventually succeed, and brilliantly so. Because, unlike his father, Stephen had, as his mother termed it, a stick-to-it nature, which must have come from his mother. 2. Durham, Maine. Stand by Me. The King family, particularly David and Stephen, bounced around like pinballs among relatives on both sides of the family all over the map. As David King recalled in an interview with Spignesi in The Complete Stephen King Encyclopedia, when we were very small, I heard that we lived in Scarborough for a while, and then we lived in a place called Croton-on-Hudson, New York. That part is just hearsay, of course, because I really don't remember that. And then there was a period of time when Stevie stayed with Ethelyn, my mother's sister, and Orrin Flaws in Durham, and I stayed with Molly, another of her sisters, down in Malden, Massachusetts. Mother was working. I don't remember too much of that. I do remember one thing, though. Mom came to visit me at Molly's once, and I remember at breakfast time Molly always used to put wheat germ on our cereal, and I told my mother that my aunt was feeding us germs. After that, we went to live with my grandmother on my father's side in Chicago for a period. I was in kindergarten at the time. I can remember at one time seeing a picture of me in my kindergarten class. All of us in the class had made Easter bonnets out of paper and whatnot. I don't know if that picture is still in existence or not. I can vaguely remember that we had a dog, and that the dog was kept in the front yard, and so you had to be very careful where you walked. After Wisconsin, we then went to live with my father's sister, Betty, and a lady she stayed with named Rudy. We have a picture of that somewhere, too. Stevie and I sitting on a lawn in front of a house. That was in the Fort Wayne, Indiana area. Aunt Betty was a school teacher, as was Rudy, and I skipped second grade because she thought that I should. After that, we lived in an apartment of our own in Fort Wayne. I can remember some of that. We shared the apartment with a number of cockroaches. It was an apartment house, but I'm not sure if it was a single-family dwelling or if there were a couple of apartments in it. They finally planted geographic roots in Durham, Maine in 1958. For the next 8 years, it would be the place they called home. The King's small home was a stone's throw from Methodist's Corner, named after a local church. It housed Ruth, her two sons, and also her parents, then in their 80s and in declining health. Like most towns in Maine, Durham is rural. Chris Chesley, who was a young teenager living there in the late 50s, recalled that most people in town commuted to bigger, nearby towns to make a living. Chris's recollection was that they were all poor, or at least not well off. In 1962, noted Stephen King in On Writing, Durham's population was approximately 900. Its population, according to the 2000 census, was only 1,496 households, 3,381 people. Unlike most writers who grew up in comfortable surroundings, whether in urban or suburban environments, Stephen King and his family had a hardscrabble life. There were no luxuries. Understandably, his early fiction reflected a desire to escape, and he did it through his rich imagination, which transported him away from the rural dreariness of Durham. It was the only world he knew, though in later years he made more frequent trips to nearby Lisbon Falls, where he saw life unfold in small-town Maine. A working-class town, with the Warrumbo Mill as its primary employer, it was surrounded by small-town stores, shops, and businesses. The mill burned down in 1987. Durham is mostly open fields, farmland, inexpensive single-family homes strung out on remote roads, and churches that formed its social hub. Its principal landmark is a large lake called Runaround Pond. In later years, Stephen King's references to himself as a hick can be seen as self-deprecation. Clearly, he was never a stereotyped Mainer, parodied in Creepshow, in which he played a hayseed farmer named Jordy Verrill. Back then, in the late 50s and early 60s, Stephen King knew that, financially, his family wasn't well off. But he did not consider them poor. Grounded in the reality of living in rural Maine, King's early values, hard work, honoring the family, self-sustainment, and lack of pretense, would later be reflected in the naturalism of his fiction. King wasn't the literary equivalent of John Updike writing about the solidly middle-class folks who come from away, a Maine term for non-Mainers. King didn't write about the affluent tourists who come to Bar Harbor or other scenic destinations. Instead, he wrote about the blue-collar working class, because that was what he saw growing up in Durham. Without the distractions of big city life, or even small city life on the scale of nearby Lisbon Falls, Durham was simple and unglamorous. His friends back then accepted him for who and what he was, a big, goofy kid who found self-worth in writing. He wore thick black glasses and spent most of his time inside a cramped upstairs bedroom that he shared with his older brother David, who, along with an old, battered manual typewriter and his overactive imagination, were Stephen's constant companions. King's life and times as a teenager were captured with fidelity in his story, The Body, set in rural Maine and fictionalized as Castle Rock. The film version was shot in Oregon. In The Body, King wrote, "I never had any friends later on like the ones I had when I was 12. Jesus, did you?" adapted by director Rob Reiner as Stand By Me. The body perfectly encapsulates the life and times of a young Stephen King growing up in rural Maine. The first-person narrator, in fact, is Gordy LaChance, who finds validation in himself through his storytelling. Gordy's great fear, even as a young teen, is that he, like many of the others, would be trapped in Castle Rock and never realize his dreams. At one point, Gordy asks his best friend, Chris, "I'm never gonna get out of this town, am I, Gordy?" Gordy replies, "You can do anything you want, man." In the end, it is not Gordy who becomes a permanent resident of Castle Rock. That would be John Ace Merrill, who bullied him when they were younger and has become a fixture in the small town. As an adult, Gordon sees Ace leaving work from his job at the local mill and heading into a bar called the Mellow Tiger. Ace is now a 32-year-old man, no longer lean and mean as he was in his teens, but overweight and resigned to his mundane life. Gordy looks on and thinks, "So that's what Ace is now." Their world has moved on, and when life's cards have been dealt, it's Ace who holds the losing hand. He's the joker. The winning hand is held by Gordy, who grew up, matured, and finally escaped the confines of rural Maine. "I'm a writer now, like I said. A lot of critics think what I write is shit. A lot of the time I think they are right. But it still freaks me out to put those words, freelance writer, down in the occupation blank of the forms you have to fill out at credit desks and in doctor's offices. But time is a river, and like the rushing waters of the Androscoggin River that runs through Lisbon Falls, past the abandoned Warrumbo Mill where Stephen King once worked, life, too, moves on." Seduction of the Innocent. "I think Hitler was a beginner compared to the comic book industry." Dr. Frederick Wertham, on an industry he railed against. The infamous cover to Crime Suspense Stories, an EC Comics book, showed a man with a bloody axe in one hand and a severed woman's head in the other. Just so the readers get the point, her lifeless body lays on the floor. The message, the psychiatrist Frederick Wertham pointed out to a Senate subcommittee on juvenile delinquency, was that comics, all comics, not just the grisly fair EC comics published, were in effect a seduction of the innocent. Children had to be protected from the insidious scourge of comic books. In his 1954 Seduction of the Innocent, The Influence of Comic Books on Today's Youth, he writes about Batman. "Several years ago, a California psychiatrist pointed out that the Batman stories are psychologically homosexual. Our research confirms this entirely. Only someone ignorant of the fundamentals of psychiatry and of the psychopathology of sex can fail to realize a subtle atmosphere of homoeroticism which pervades the adventures of the mature Batman and his young friend, Robin. Wonder Woman and Black Cat get no better treatment. The lesbian counterpart of Batman can be found in the stories of Wonder Woman and Black Cat. The homosexual connotation of the Wonder Woman type of story is psychologically unmistakable." To which any sane person should reply, "Horsepucky." As did Michael Chabon, who, in the New York Times, February 19, 2013, said, "You read the book, it just smells wrong." It's clear he got completely carried away with his obsession in an almost Ahab-like way. Now thoroughly discredited, most significantly by Carol L. Tilley from the University of Illinois' Graduate School of Library and Information Science, Wertham's findings were twisted to serve his purposes. As Tilley told Dave Itzkoff, a writer for the New York Times, Wertham manipulated, overstated, compromised, and fabricated evidence, leading her to conclude that he was carried away with his own preconceptions, his own agenda, that became perhaps disconnected from the kids that he was treating and observing. Scholar Finds Flaws in Arch Enemy of Comics, February 19, 2013. Wertham's book was a sign of the times. It was the era of Senator Joseph McCarthy, who saw communists under every bed. For good reason, cartoonist Walt Kelly, in his strip Pogo, depicted the senator as a bobcat named Simple J. Malarkey. The 50s was a time of national fear. The boogeyman didn't lurk in the closet to come out under cover of darkness. He lived in radioactive clouds and communism, and in an atmosphere of suspicion and censure that bracketed the baby boomers' lives, including a young, impressionable Stephen King. Back then, pop culture, especially movies, reflected the fear of atomic attacks, such as Japanese movies that proclaimed their public fear of nuclear annihilation, and for just cause. In 1945, two atomic bombs spread radioactive death on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Back in the day, in the fright-filled 50s, popular culture, including movies, comic books, cheap horror and science fiction paperbacks, and television shows, was the fountain from which impressionable youth drank. Among them, youngsters named George Lucas, 3 years older than King, and Steven Spielberg, 1 year older than King, who wholeheartedly embraced popular culture, adamantly rejecting Wertham's thesis that comics, and by extension movies and television, constituted a wholesale seduction of the innocent. If comics were a seduction, then Stephen King was willingly seduced. And so were millions of other kids who found pop culture theirs to embrace. It was, in short, their preferred literature. It was also the final years of radio dramatizations as a form of mass entertainment. As King pointed out in Danse Macabre, "I am of the last quarter of the last generation that remembers radio drama as an active force, a dramatic art form with its own set of reality." In 1947, for instance, there were 40 million radios in American homes, but only 44,000 television sets. In the 50s, when King was growing up, TV displaced radio, and by 1958, television was the undisputed king. Back then, viewers used antennas on top of televisions, rabbit ears to get reception, and could choose among only three networks, ABC, CBS, and NBC. And programs were broadcast in black and white. Classics Illustrated. Ruth King clearly had a mind of her own, and did not share the views of Dr. Frederick Wertham. She enjoyed reading comics aloud to her sons, who loved listening to her. From the time Stephen was 6 years old until he was 10, Ruth read comics to her sons. Celebrated for her dramatic skills in high school, Ruth was an excellent reader and chose her reading material well. She read from the Classic Illustrated line, Classic Comics, until 1947, which issued adaptations of classics in the public domain, among them Ivanhoe, The Count of Monte Cristo, Moby Dick, A Tale of Two Cities, and Robin Hood. The comics were well drawn and, clearly, wholesome fare, though Wertham's book specifically cited their unwholesome and corrupting adaptions of Uncle Tom's Cabin and Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. The comic books, accessible and bought at local drugstores or other retailers, were pathways to real books. Classics Illustrated enjoyed a long run and went on to produce 169 issues. Comic books were King's constant companions as a child, when he suffered an extended illness and thus missed much of first grade. Bedridden for the better part of a year, he found entertainment in 6 tons of comic books, on writing. As he explained, "At some point I began to write my own stories. Imitation precedes creation. I would copy Combat Casey comics word for word in my Blue Horse tablet, sometimes adding my own descriptions where they seemed appropriate. Comics, an artful blend of art and text, rely heavily on the visual, which contributed to how King saw the world through the lens of four-color comics. King initially came to writing not from the classics in prose form, but through comic book adaptations of the same. At an early age, inspired by movies and comics, he began to write visually, which became one of his trademarks. As King pointed out in On Writing, his mother was impressed with his early imitative efforts, but thought little of the physical violence in Combat Casey. She also felt that if he was going to write, he should do it his way. "I bet you could do better," she told him. "Write one of your own." He would do just that. An Honest Buck. As Stephen King recounted in On Writing, he was mindful of his mother's admonition when he penned a 4-page story about a character named Mr. Rabbit Trick, who was the leader of magic animals who rode around in an old car helping out little kids. After confirming that this was an original story, Ruth praised it. She said it was good enough to be in a book. "Nothing anyone has said to me since has made me feel any happier," Stephen asserted in On Writing. He immediately sat down and pulled 4 more rabbit stories out of his hat, for which his mother gave him 4 quarters, and distributed the stories to her 4 sisters. It was an honest buck earned, and his mother's encouragement and approval was like manna from heaven for the 7-year-old eager to please his mother and prove himself. No doubt his aunts were bemused by his fledgling literary effort. It was a good start, but not King's milieu. Bunny Rabbit stories, like Trick's cereal, is for kids. He was destined for more gruesome fare. Rabbit stew, anyone? In time, the needle swung, hovering over the true north of his fictional interests. In The Art of Darkness, King recalls the first horror-slash-science-fiction story he ever wrote, at age 7. "I wrote about this big dinosaur that was really ripping ass all over everything." Though low on scientific plausibility, the dinosaur is eventually dispatched by leather clothing and boots thrown at it. It was a start. His patented stories would get better over time, but given King's lack of interest and aptitude with science in general, storytelling, not science, would always carry the day, if not the tale. King submits fiction professionally. In terms of his interests in writing, the turning point came when King was 12, when he got his first typewriter, a heavy-duty Underwood, which allowed him to produce professional-looking manuscripts, which was critical because magazine publishers didn't accept handwritten manuscripts. But King's typewriter couldn't bear up under his constant key pounding, which eventually broke off the ends of the type bars, which meant he had to fill in missing letters by hand. Douglas E. Winter in The Art of Darkness explains that King submitted to Fantastic, edited by Seal Goldsmith. She was also its slush pile reader and would have been the one who read King's early submissions and would likely have been surprised to learn that he was a young teenager. We don't know what short fiction he submitted to Goldsmith. We only know that his stories were rejected with pre-printed rejection slips with variations of "Thank you, but no thanks." In Sam Barry and Kathy Kamen Goldmark's book, Write That Book Already, King recalled at this time, "When I was 16, I pounded a spike into my bedroom wall and started spiking rejection slips. The spike tore out of the wall 4 years later. I was home on semester break from college when it went. I counted, and there were over 150 rejection slips on it, which didn't count the slips that came to my college dorm. After that, I just piled them up. I sold my first story about 8 months later." Among them, King submitted to the most prestigious publication in the field, the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. As with Fantastic, Fantasy and science fiction initially rejected King's work with form rejection slips that were like stretched socks. One size fit all. Like fantastic, fantasy and science fiction didn't pay fantastic word rates. They paid only a few pennies per word. But unlike fantastic, fantasy and science fiction encouraged King. The editor at that time was a well-known fantasy writer named Avram Davidson, an award-winning writer who was at the helm of the magazine from 1962, when King was only 15, to 1964. In Art of Darkness, Winter noted that Davidson had rejected a story on the grounds that it was more horror than science fiction, which was true. King was no Peter Parker in the lab. In fact, in King's fiction, the science is not rigorous. Science fiction, especially hard science fiction, the kind written by Robert A. Heinlein, Arthur C. Clarke, and Isaac Asimov, was not King's thing. King's thing was anything that slithered, oozed, and went bump in the night. Monsters, not handsome, rock-jawed spacemen in shining uniforms, dispatching bug-eyed monsters slavering after shapely, buxom blonde women in tight-fitting clothes. No wonder, then, that King instead found his interest in the dark side of human nature, including teenage killer Charles Charlie Starkweather, a figure of fascination to a young, impressionable Stephen King. Using a .22 rifle, a .410 shotgun, a handgun, and a knife, Starkweather dispatched his 11 victims in a one-month period between 1957 and 1958, accompanied by his 14-year-old girlfriend. When Stephen constructed a scrapbook of Starkweather's rampage across Nebraska and Wyoming, it gave Ruth King pause. As Stephen King told Winter in an interview for The Art of Darkness, "My mother was ready to have me placed in analysis." No Flowers in the Attic. The Avon paperbacks, digest-size anthologies termed samplers, were intended to provide a cross-section of storytellers who wrote in the same vein, with the hope of tapping into new blood, first-time readers who would come back for more. Recalling with great fondness one Avon book, an H.P. Lovecraft anthology with a lurid cover that depicts a cemetery with a creature emerging from beneath a tombstone, King noted in Danse Macabre that it remains the one which best sums up H.P.L.'s work for me. Stephen's first encounter with serious fantasy horror fiction showed him that more than two decades earlier, supernatural fiction, regarded by many as escapist trash, was written with serious intent. Lovecraft, he realized, wasn't screwing around. He meant it, and it was his seriousness as much as anything else which that interior dowsing rod responded to, King wrote in Danse Macabre. Reading in the horror field meant discovering other writers, and it wasn't long before King encountered the work of a California writer named Richard Matheson, who wrote about horror in a contemporary vein. The monsters weren't in moldering graveyards and decrepit castles in Europe, but in American cities. His best-known novel, I Am Legend, published in 1945, single-handedly popularized the vampire genre and the disease-borne apocalypse, both major themes that would show up later in King's novels for Doubleday, Salem's Lot, and The Stand. In Dark Dreamers, Matheson told Stanley Wyatter, "King said that because of reading I Am Legend. He realized it was not necessary to write everything like H.P. Lovecraft, that you could have a contemporary shopping mall, housing tract setting, and still do a horror story. So that was very crucial in his decision as to what he was going to write." King, in an interview with Winter in Art of Darkness, elaborated, "I realized then that horror didn't have to happen in a haunted castle. It could happen in the suburbs, on your street, maybe next door. In other words, it could happen anywhere, even in your own home." It was time to drive a stake through the heart of horror fiction set in cobwebbed Europe. It was time to bring the horror to small-town America. And King would do just that. King embarked on a path that would make him the king of horror, the darkest of the dark dreamers. Silver screens at the Ritz and Poe Pictures. It's no coincidence that King's writing is cinematic. During his impressionable youth, King haunted the Ritz Theater in nearby Lewistown. In On Writing, he explained, "I wanted monsters that ate whole cities, radioactive corpses that came out of the ocean and ate surfers, and girls in black bras who looked like trailer trash." King and his friend Chris Chesley enjoyed what they termed Poe Pictures. It was a reference to Roger Corman's movies, such as The Pit and the Pendulum, The Premature Burial, Tales of Terror, The Raven, The Mask of the Red Death, and The Tomb of Ligeia, which were loosely inspired by Edgar Allan Poe's fiction. Back then, kids didn't sit sedately in their seats. The matinees were participatory theaters, with kids shouting out warnings to the actors on screen when danger lurked. For most kids, the matinee was just a good time. But for King, the experience of seeing movies was a lot more valuable. In the Complete Stephen King Encyclopedia, Chesley observed that Steve was very influenced by the movies. He would write up sequences for these stories. For instance,